It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's our holiday special. Now, no matter where you are or what you believe, this is a remarkable time of year. In the Northern Hemisphere, it's about thumbing our noses at the dark. In the South, it's about celebrating the light. But wherever you go, it's always about feasting. Now, we have some guides today. We head to Oaxaca, Mexico with Chef Rick Bayless. In London, we meet up with culinary iconoclast Nigella Lawson. In France, Patricia Wells shares holidays in Paris. We get the best of India's celebrations with actress and food authority Madhur Jaffrey. And here at home, our road food duo Jane and Michael Stern have found a wonderfully wacky place to celebrate year-round. All this and more coming up on this special edition of The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to a special holiday edition of The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today, it's the three R's our way. We're talking a holiday guide to reveling, relaxing, and maybe even reflecting. Of course, we're throwing in a mite bit of excess. Great food around the world. Chef and Mexican food expert Rick Bayless spends every Christmas in Oaxaca, and he's going to take us inside the holiday there. Our sommelier turned wine maverick, Joshua Wesson, tells us what to do with those gift bottles, drink them up, or stash them away. We have India's holidays with actress and food authority Madhur Jaffrey. In London, we talk life, food, and Christmas dinner with British TV food star Nigella Lawson. It's Christmas in Paris with Patricia Wells, and then I'm taking you to Italy. But let's get things started right here at home with those American road food experts, Jane and Michael Stern. They are the authors of the classic Eat Your Way Across the USA, and they write the monthly column Road Food in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, how are you going to spend the holidays? I figure with all the traveling you two do, you have found a prime place.
Well, let me just tell you something, Lynn. First of all, in the good old days, people used to prepare for Christmas 2 weeks before Christmas. Now you start preparing for Christmas on December 26th for the upcoming year. So, for all of our listeners who are complete Christmas fanatics, which I think half the world has become, we are going to one of our favorite places in the world, which is Frankenmuth, Michigan, which is a town absolutely devoted to everything concerning Christmas.
Frankenmuth, Michigan has not only the world's largest family-owned restaurant where they serve gigantic fried chicken dinners, they also have the world's largest Christmas store. Both happen to be operated by the same family.
Now, really huge. I mean, we're talking about a store where you can hear Silent Night sung in 286 different languages. I think it's 6 acres of Christmas hoo-has and doodads for sale.
They say that it's 5.5 football fields worth of Christmas stuff. Everything from their trademarked life-size fiberglass nativity scene to pre-lit Christmas trees in all shades of green, white, and pink.
So after you shop till you drop and you're dragging your life-size nativity scene with you in a bag, you go to the restaurant at Frankenmuth and you order truly one of the largest meals that we have ever had. Michael, all I remember is the fried chicken, and you can get an extra side of fried chicken livers with it. Do you remember what else is on the menu?
Yes, if I may. For $16.50, all you can eat, you get noodle soup, cabbage salad, cheese spread, chicken liver pate, garlic toast, stolen bread, white bread, preserves, cottage cheese, relish, fried chicken, all you can eat, Grandma's Zender's dressing, mashed potatoes, gravy, noodles, vegetables, and a dish of ice cream.
A dish of ice cream. Somehow that seems so meager.
And after this meal, you too will be 5.5 football fields wide.
So you can do this all through Christmas week, right? I mean, all through
you
the holidays.
You can do it all year round.
Except, and I think this is kind of heresy, they're actually closed on Christmas Day. But, you know, every other day of the year, I think, no, they're also closed on Thanksgiving. You can go and you can just go Christmas wild. I mean, you can have Christmas mania. You can, you know, drape yourself with every possible light and ornament and an angel and cotton floss that you can think of. And then you will just bring your family in and sit family style and have this huge chicken dinner.
Not to make the Christmas stuff sound too commercial, in addition, you can buy a Bible in any one of 20 different languages there.
Well, that's good gift giving, you know,
yes.
Send it to friends abroad and that kind of thing. But
I just wonder what the 286 renditions of Silent Night, what languages could they put? You think like it's in Hottentot or something? I mean, I really want to know what some of the stranger ones are.
Well, I want to know, where is this place in Michigan?
Frankenmuth, Michigan. It's in the lower part of Michigan. It's fairly centrally located. And it's a real destination kind of place. I mean, in the month leading up to Christmas, it's mobbed. I mean, the streets are mobbed with people having a wonderful time buying stuff and eating chicken.
Well, I don't know. You know, if you really want to keep the Christmas spirit through the whole holiday, it sounds like a great place to go. Hey, guys, thank
it's
you.
It's a lot of fun.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye, Lynn.
Happy
Bye,
holidays.
Merry Christmas to me.
Merry Christmas to you.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, riding down Santa Claus Lane. Blitzen, blitzen, all here's a reindeer pulling on a rein. Bells are ringing, children sing, all is merry and bright. Hang your stockings and say your prayers, 'cause Santa Claus come tonight.
The Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Wine expert Joshua Wesson went through a paradigm shift a while ago, from being a sommelier selling extremely pricey bottles to being a man who believes modest money can buy very good sipping. So now Josh roams the world looking for bargains that he sells in his bestsellers wine stores. Hey, Josh, I'm so glad to have you back.
Oh, I love you, Lynn, and I really love being here. And I wish that I could stay here all the time with you.
Oh, you're getting very mushy. It's holiday time.
I'm emotionally labile.
Yeah, Josh, we always talk about wines to bring to parties, but I want to flip it over. What do you do with the wines that people bring to you, to your house? I mean, how do you know when to drink them?
You know, it's a great question that never gets asked, because everybody, if they are, you know, in any way social, will invite people over at one time or another. And of course, somebody's going to bring wine. And if you don't open it the night that you get it, you stick it in your refrigerator in the lettuce bin, or you put it up behind, up in the cabinet. Maybe you put it in your sock drawer, and then you forget about it until you stumble over it at some point later in the year. And you wonder, should I have had it? Is it good? Is it bad? Sometimes you stumble over it years after you've gotten it. So I think it's a great question to ask. How do you get rid of the stuff? When should you drink it?
Yeah, well, I don't even know if it's get rid of, but, you know, often it's stuff I don't have a clue about. So are there guidelines, I guess, is what I need to know.
Yeah, and I get nobody get rid of it. I mean, when should you make a moment of these wines?
Yeah.
Well, here's my shorthand set of recommendations. If it's a bottle of sparkling wine or champagne,
right,
open it up. The next time you feel like having a bottle of bubbles, or better yet, when you don't even feel like having a bottle of bubbles, just open it up and make that evening a celebration, because opening champagne and opening sparkling wine enhances the quality of anything that you do, whether you're pouring Rice Krispies in the morning or you're opening up your Con Ed bills. It doesn't matter. It makes it better.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sparkling wines and champagnes don't really benefit that much from aging, and they can lose their effervescence over time. So when in doubt, you know, open it up and pour it out is what I say when it comes to sparkling wine.
Okay. What about regular whites?
Well, most white wines in the world are meant to be consumed within a few years of the vintage. There are a handful that benefit from age. But it's another case of when in doubt, pour it out. I would say that that white wines, whether they're Chardonnay-based or Sauvignon Blanc-based, are best consumed, you know, on the closer side of the mountain. So get those things on the table if you've been given them over the last year or two, and open them up and enjoy them. You can't drink them fast enough if they're white wines that were given to you as a gift.
All right, now the reds. Now the reds can be tricky because you have light-bodied reds, and of course you've got the big muscly reds.
Mm-hmm. Well, generally, you can tell which are which by the weight of the bottle.
Really?
You pick up, if the bottle's really heavy, if it's a red wine bottle that feels like a champagne bottle.
Right.
I absolutely would not worry. You don't have to open it up. You can let it sit, you know, and rest and just pull it out whenever you want to, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. But if it's a normal weight bottle and you can see through it, hold it up to a light.
Uh-huh.
And if you can see through it, then it's a good candidate for opening up before the new year comes and goes.
Because it's a light-bodied wine.
It's a light-bodied wine, and, you know, wines are built like houses are built. You know, if they're light-bodied, they're not going to have the same frame as a big, rich red, and they're going to be meant to be consumed on the earlier side of their life cycle. And another tip that I would suggest with any red wine that you have, whether it's a big, thick, heavy bottle or a lighter bottle that you can see through, throw it in the fridge for 15 minutes before you open it, and it'll make it that much better, especially if it's a slightly older bottle, because you'll want to frame some of the acid and the tannin and the fruit. And there's something about 15 minutes in a fridge that focuses all of those elements together and will put the wine at its best.
That's phenomenal. All right, the last category, sweet wines, because I've heard sweet wines you could keep forever.
Well, sure. You think about what preserves food. Salt preserves food, and acid preserves food, and sugar preserves food. So there's no reason why that same logic wouldn't apply to a bottle of wine.
Mm-hmm.
If you're given a sweet bottle of wine, it can last for a very long time. But here's the thing. Most people think that sweet wines have to be consumed with dessert. And I love sweet wine as dessert, or maybe even just as a glass of wine to have late into the evening. You're not thinking about what you're going to pair it with. You're just going to be mellow and kick back and look at the fire. And if you don't have a fire, then last year I bought one of those videotapes that has a Yule log in it. You put that in the VCR. I think I'm one of the only people that still uses videotape, but that's neither here nor there. I'm sure they do it on a DVD now. And you watch the flames licking on the television set, and you're staring above your toes, and you're drinking a nice glass of Sauternes or a late harvest Sauvignon Blanc or a port or a sherry, and you're going to be in heaven.
You know, those are also fabulous with blue cheeses.
Mm. Oh,
that's
yes.
Just thought of that. Hey, Josh, thank you.
I'll be crumbling and mumbling.
And Happy New Year to you.
To you, too.
Joshua Wesson is co-author of the cult favorite Red Wine with Fish, and he is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Well, from where I'm sitting, if ever there was a perfect week to sip some bubbly, it's this one. Now, you've always heard that you can drink sparkling wine with almost any food, but don't make the mistake that a lot of people do. Don't think that the food has to be fancy. I mean, believe it or not, one of the best things to eat with champagne is popcorn, because champagne and salty stuff marry up brilliantly. Now, my two favorite budget bubblies are Prosecco from Italy and Cava from Spain. Now, Cava is usually crisp and dry, which means grilled fish, roast chicken, or anything creamy. Really love it. Prosecco often has a lot of fruit, so you can pair it with things like grapes or goat cheese with apples. And this is the wine to sip with fruitcake and butter cookies. Of course, my favorite pairing came from Josh, and I'm going to wake up some of my very serious wine friends with it this holiday. Are you ready? Well, it's Asti Spumante with Twinkies. Coming up, Britain's lusty cook Nigella Lawson, Chef Rick Bayless takes us to his Christmas in Oaxaca, Mexico, and celebrating in the City of Light with Patricia Wells. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to the Splendid Table Holiday Special from American Public Media. Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. We're looking at holiday celebration worldwide today, and we're starting in the land of Tiny Tim, London. Now, we're going there to celebrate with an iconoclast, the woman who changed the look of the TV food show. When Nigella Lawson's first series hit the tube on both sides of the Atlantic, she broke the mold. Here was a woman who made no claims of being an expert, looked gorgeous, loved to eat, loved cooking for her kids, and is utterly practical. This is a woman who loves the act of cooking, but who also has a life. She writes a bi-monthly column for the New York Times, hosts Forever Summer with Nigella and Nigella Bites on the Style Network, and is author of her latest book, the aptly named Feast. Nigella, welcome.
Oh, thank you. What a lovely welcome it is, too. Thanks a lot.
Well, how are the States treating you?
Oh, I love it here. I mean, what I find particularly is that when I get to the States is that people are always very relieved to meet such a mess. And I'm not even insulted when they say that. Just simply that, you know, as you were saying, cooking is about what happens at home. It's not really what happens in restaurants. Fabulous though that is. And, you know, I love the food that the great chefs make. But I think it's so important to remember that cooking is just what happens in people's homes. And I think other people too are relieved because they see, you know, I chop a carrot, I spill some on the ground, you know, I'm pouring some milk into a jug, some of it splashes on the counter. And so I'm not insulted by the notion of mess because actually when we're cooking in real lives, we don't have that much time to put on a performance or to get everything right. What you're trying to do is get supper on the table. And that's people, everyone appreciates that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, right now is about a lot of entertaining. What do you think makes a good party?
It's so important. I feel so crucial not to go overboard with really cooking things which are going to make you stressed. Because there is nothing worse than not being able to enjoy the company of your friends and the whole holiday spirit because you've given yourself 22 different things to do 5 minutes ago. So I also think that I have a kind of rule which is it's always better to have a huge amount of a very few things rather than lots and lots of things but only in small quantities because I always feel abundance is what feels welcoming. I think you want to feel everyone can have second, third helpings and there'll still be more. And somehow I love that rather old-fashioned idea, which sort of feels appropriate at this time of year, of the, you know, the groaning boards. You know, those old paintings with these thick, heavy wooden tables and a huge hunk of meat and a huge wodge of cheese and, you know, thick cloth. And you sort of feel I want to be in that painting.
Well, what is Christmas like at your house? What are the traditions for you and your children?
Well, we have very few traditions, but those traditions we have are immutable. So I'm not really very good. I mean, I'm not very good with my hands. I can't do any sort of craft or anything like that. But one thing I do with my children is we make the edible Christmas tree decorations. And so I make this sort of rather heavily, I'm a mean mother, you know. I really spice them because if I make them too nice to eat, then the minute they're up on the tree, they take them down. So I add a bit of black pepper to the cookie mix so that they just, you know, maybe pick off a bit of the icing. You know, my children both, you know, I think they're the sort of implicit style guru is Donatella Versace. Any colour goes on. The more baubles, the better. I mean, they look gaudy. So we have this very oddly decorated tree with many different art styles going on it. And just in case I'm creating this picture of, you know, lovingness by the stove, you know, the amount of rows that go on while we're doing this is just, you can't believe, because my children always in the end start putting their faces straight into the bowl of frosting. I mean, anyway, Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without a family row, would it?
No, I don't think so. No. You were going to leave us with an entertaining menu, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about it. We've got this slow roast shoulder of pork that stays in the oven for almost 20 hours and it just melts in your mouth. But there's something you have on the menu that
I'd like you to tell us about specifically, it's Liptauer cheese as an hors d'oeuvre. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I certainly can. Now, no one really knows what Liptauer is, and I don't blame them because you never really find it now. When I was a child, I remember so well going with my mother to delis, and I can remember because my eyes must have been just where the counter started, you know, quite low down, and there'd be this mound of creamy white cheese flecked with green and brown and kind of like rivulets of orange running over it. And we used to eat this at home a lot. And I've since found out it is really an Eastern European speciality, which is a mixture of cream cheese and cottage cheese. You just mix that with capers and teeny little gherkins and a bit of paprika, some caraway seeds, a bit of French mustard. You mix that together and you can mold it in a kind of tub-shaped bowl. You can do anything with it. And then what you do later is make a little runny paste just of paprika and some very low-flavoured flavours, groundnut oil, something like that, and you just drizzle that over. And the mixture of that cream cheese with the spices and the mustard, and I love it on pumpernickel or black bread or bagels, anything. And it's one of those things that people always look like you're a bit mad when you first suggest it, but you cannot have just one bit of it. You find that if you make it at a party, no one moves from where it is. They're just hovering so they can keep putting their knife back in.
You have this lovely ending to the menu, the bitter orange ice cream.
Well, I love, you know, I like anything with the word bitter in it. You know, I feel it's very, very, I like it when everyone's feeling so warm-spirited, just to add this note. Now, the bitter oranges in question are really Seville oranges, which don't really come into the stores till January, if at all. But you can approximate Seville, a bitter orange, very, very easily by mixing ordinary sweet-eating orange with a bit of lime. And you get then the intensity of the deepest orange flavour without it being sweet. And so, I don't know, I can't, it really sets it off well. And the reason I do this ice cream a lot is because you don't need a churn. You don't need an ice cream maker. You're just mixing, frankly, the zests, the juice, some cream, some sugar. You just put it in a container, you put it in the freezer. So it can't be any easier than that, frankly.
Sounds perfect to me. Nigella Lawson, thank you so much and happy holidays.
Same to you. Thank you.
Nigella Lawson's TV show, Nigella Bites, can be seen on the Style Network. Her latest book is Feast. Nigella left us with a little holiday menu. Liptauer cheese, slow-roasted aromatic pork shoulder, and bitter orange ice cream. Now you can find all the recipes and lots more feasting ideas on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I have to tell you, I love this idea of the roast pork because it brings up my favorite holiday theory. Now, I think fat and celebration are inseparable, at least historically. Here are the facts. Much of the Western world used to be fat poor, at least the working class was. People sold whatever fat they might produce, except at holiday time. Now, part of celebrating has always been an act of defying the fates, especially if you're poor. You're saying, times are going to be better. You share what you usually hoard, you cook the goose, you slather in the butter, you fry in the olive oil. Why, in the old days, it was damn the torpedoes and full fat ahead. Sort of puts dieting in perspective, doesn't it? Right across the channel from Nigella is our favorite American in Paris, food expert Patricia Wells. Now, most people think April in Paris, but trust me, if you want to see Paris shine, go at Christmas. Patricia Wells has lived there for over 20 years. She was the first woman and the only foreigner to become restaurant critic for the magazine L'Express. She writes for the International Herald Tribune. Her latest book is The Provence Cookbook. Patricia Wells, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Lynn.
So you live in Paris most of the time.
Yes, I kind of split my time 50-50 between Paris and Provence. But in the wintertime, we're in Paris more often because it's kind of cold and lonely.
So what's Paris like at Christmas?
It just shines. You know, it really does. Even the most touristy spots like the Champs-Élysées and the Eiffel Tower, they really just look so beautiful. But it's such elegant, elegant decorations.
Is there the stress on gifts and buying there the way it is here?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think there's, you know, you give people little gifts, but not the, you know, 9,000 things under the tree kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are people eating? I mean, what's a traditional Christmas feast? And is it Christmas or is it Christmas Eve where the emphasis is?
Christmas Eve is the emphasis, right. Christmas Eve, they would normally have like turkey or capon is very popular then. Mostly roast poultry, I would say, or goose, roast goose. They would always obviously have lots of chocolate desserts. That's the very most important thing, to have either croquant bouche or the bouche de Noël, would be purchased and not made at home. Almost very few desserts are made in the home for holidays. In fact, I think something like 80% of the chocolate sold in France are sold at Christmas time.
Uh-huh. Are there hors d'oeuvre beforehand, oysters or caviar or that
definitely
kind of thing?
Caviar, oysters, foie gras. Of course, you have to have foie gras. That's the most ultimate. You have to have that for Christmas. So you might even have caviar, foie gras, oysters, maybe a whole plateau de fruits de mer of lots of oysters and fish and shellfish together, maybe some smoked salmon, and then you would have your main course.
Now, do you eat early or do you eat late?
Actually, they would have a lighter meal before midnight mass, and then have a larger meal after the mass. So that's kind of late eating.
And Christmas Day, I mean, are people just lolling around trying to digest, or are you eating again?
So. No, well, eating again, of course, in Paris, yes, you have to be eating again. And it's interesting, Christmas is very much a family time. So you would rarely be invited to someone's home, a French person's home, for Christmas. Whereas New Year's is the adult time. And so New Year's is when the adults go out and have a good time and go dancing and so on and so forth. It's very distinctive.
And that would be a time for friends and getting together
in
a different way.
But unless you were really intimate with the family, you would not get invited to their home for Christmas.
I just picture everybody feasting at a rate that's, you know, incomprehensible.
And, of course, we haven't talked about the wines, but, of course, you'd have to have lots of champagne, magnums of champagne. And if you're in Paris, you'd probably have to have your old Bordeaux's.
So you really pull out all the stops.
Absolutely.
Even the most modest families will eat this
Absolutely. Way? Absolutely. They do pull out all stops for food, and especially for feasts.
Well, thank you. I'm ready to go.
You're invited.
Thank you. Patricia Wells' latest book is The Provence Cookbook. You can find Pat's recipe for a really refreshing dessert, perfect to lighten up the feasting. It's fresh lemon juice tart, and you can find it right on our website, splendidtable.org. Pat brought back a great memory. New Year's Eve in Paris, standing on a bread line. The line was at Poilin, a legendary bakery. They still did these big, round country loaves by hand, and they had one of the oldest wood-fired ovens in the city. Now, we never left Paris without a loaf. We were lucky enough to be living up the road in Brussels. We'd been eating nonstop for a week. You see, we didn't know how long we were going to be in Europe, so our philosophy was, as long as our legs and our livers held out, we were going to be fine. So picture this. It's New Year's Eve. Stone cold. The line is down the block waiting for the last bake. Now, in France, a lot of bakeries bake fresh bread every 2 hours. There's a funny story about this, by the way. Shortly before we were on that line, a Soviet news crew had filmed at Poilin, reporting that Western economies were collapsing, and the proof was the Paris bread lines. Anyway, all around us, the shops were going full tilt, people were rushing home, and we were freezing to death. Then, salvation. Down the line came an old man with a big tray. It was the master baker, Father Poilin. He was so sweet, he apologized for the wait, wishing everybody Happy New Year, and passing out what he called hand warmers, big clunky whole wheat apple turnovers, hot as Hades. The crust crunched in your mouth, the apples practically melted in this buttery syrup. In fact, when some plopped on my sleeve without thinking, I licked it off. And then realized I'd been spotted by the guy behind us. But he laughed. He pulled out a bottle of cider and passed it over for a chuck-a-lug. So we reciprocated with our chocolate bars. And then somebody passed pâté down the line, and more bottles were opened. And it was party time on Rue Cherche-Midi,
with those unfriendly French. Chef Rick Bayless fell in love with Mexico nearly 30 years ago. His first book, the award-winning Authentic Mexican, proves sometimes a foreigner can see things more clearly than a native. Rick went on to open Frontera Grill and Topolobampo in Chicago. They've been called the best Mexican eateries north of the border. Next came his PBS series, Mexico One Plate at a Time, and more books and more TV. And every time I talk to Rick, he's just back from another research trip. Rick Bayless, it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's always so much fun to be with you.
Rick, what happens in Mexico at Christmas time? How is it celebrated?
Well, it depends on what part of Mexico you go to. I once spent a very dismal Christmas in Mexico City, everybody with their families behind closed doors, and I was the only one on the street. But I learned my lesson and went to Oaxaca, which has the most incredible Christmas fiestas. And they're out in the street, so anyone can partake in them. On the 22nd, the artists in the community, and it's a very artistic community, get together, and they make these little two-story high floats that they parade down the streets and sing and dance and have piñatas right in the middle of the street. The kids from the neighborhoods all come and enjoy themselves with that. Then on the 23rd, they do this festival of the radishes, which they've done for 100 years, actually over 100 years now in Oaxaca. It's a sort of celebration of the crops that are available at that time. But they grow these huge, long radishes that look like daikons, but they're red on the outside. And families and groups of friends get together and carve these intricate scenes, 100% made out of radishes held together with toothpicks. And I couldn't even begin to describe the wonder that you see on people's faces when they see these intricate carvings done. Then on the 24th, all of the parish churches put together, usually on the back of a flatbed truck, a float that portrays something about the nativity scenes. And the little kids from the parish church play all the parts. Then following that will be the church band. And following the band is the church fireworks master, shooting off fireworks into the sky. It is the most incredible thing. And there's usually about 15 of these floats, and they parade around the main square of Oaxaca. Then you go on the 24th to midnight mass at whatever church you choose in the city, and the next day is a day of relaxation. I usually go out to an open-air restaurant just outside of Oaxaca City in the town of Xáchila and have the barbecued goat that they do that's buried in the pit for 12 hours in the ground. And I invite anybody and everybody that I know in town to come out and join me for that. It usually takes about 20 or 30 people to do justice to this beautiful barbacoa of goat. So when are you coming, Lynn?
Hey, I've got my plane tickets, man. This sounds incredible. But what's traditional to eat other than the barbecued goat?
In Mexico, the typical dinner on Christmas Eve is one that starts with bacalao. Now, that's something I'm sure you know quite a bit about.
Oh, yeah. Salt cod.
The salt cod. And they have cooked it with tomatoes and capers and olives and green chilies. That's the main thing that people will always have at Christmas Eve. But you go out onto the squares, and you'll find people with these huge buñuelos. Now, that's a very, very thin, crispy fritter, about 18 inches in diameter. And they serve them dipped in a raw sugar syrup, I think is the best way to describe that, on a piece of pottery that is a second. Now, this is a potter's area, so there's lots of seconds that can't be sold in the market. You eat your buñuelo, and then you crash that second of pottery against a wall, and the more pieces that you can create in that crash, the better your luck for the next year.
Oh, my. Ah. Well, I am on the plane. Hey, Rick, thank you. And happy holiday.
Oh, happy holidays to you, too. Now, I'm looking for you in Oaxaca.
Chef and Mexican food authority Rick Bayless stars in PBS's Mexico One Plate at a Time. His latest book, which he wrote with his daughter Lainey, is Rick and Lainey's Excellent Kitchen Adventures. Rick left us with a recipe for an easy party dish, Mexican seafood stew. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, celebrating in India with Madhur Jaffrey and a stopover in Italy. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to a special holiday edition of The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. As I said earlier, no matter where you go in the world right now, you'll find some kind of celebration. Well, one of the places I've always wanted to visit at the turn of the year is India. The woman who started my love affair with Indian cooking is cookbook author Madhur Jaffrey. Now, in addition to being a food authority, Madhur is a film and stage actor. In fact, she's appearing right now on Broadway in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Bombay Dreams. Her latest cookbook is From Curries to Kebabs, Recipes from the Indian Spice Trail. Madhur Jaffrey, it's good to have you back.
It's wonderful to be back with you.
You know, with all of the different religions, I mean, in India, I'm thinking the Muslims, the Hindu, the sects, and I know there are also Christians there. How is Christmas marked in India?
Well, first of all, you should know that there are 19 million Christians in India. It's a huge amount. It's as large as some countries. So, and these are various denominations. So you say, how is it celebrated? We have the Syrian Christians who were converted by St. Thomas in the first century.
My Lord.
So we have very early Christians.
Yeah.
And we have Christians that have been converted over time by differing people. For example, St. Francis Xavier was on the western coast of India and was one of the many people instrumental in converting people to Catholicism in places like Goa, which was a Portuguese colony for a long time. So we have Syrian Christians, which are the St. Thomas converted ones. We have Catholics. We have Episcopalians. So we have the whole jing-bang lot representing all versions of Christianity. And they celebrate it differently. And I thought, I just take one community where I have gone with my family for year after year after year for a holiday, and that is Goa, which is a great holiday destination. It's right on the sea. It's tropical, which all of India isn't. People don't know that. I come from a very cold area.
Uh-huh.
So Goa is very tropical and beautiful. And I have spent many a Christmas there, and it is stunning. I go to Mass. I'm not Christian. My husband is. But we go to midnight Mass every year when we're there because it is so beautiful. So let me try and describe it to you.
Sure.
What the family start doing just before Christmas, of course, they get it from the nuns in all their convents, which is the nuns used to bake all the pastries. But now the convents are slowly dying out a little bit. So people are baking little cakes, little pastries themselves. So they spend 2 weeks before baking these pastries, and they're filled with coconut milk and palm sugar. So they're different from what you would have in any other part of the world. And then for the guests that come for Christmas, they start roasting cashews because cashews are a big crop in this area. So they have to roast off that harder, toxic shell that's on the outside.
Uh-huh.
And I tell you, these fresh cashews that are freshly roasted, there's nothing like it. on this earth. They're like chestnutty. They're absolutely wonderful. So they say offer all these little pastries and cakes to people who come before Christmas. Then they start preparing for Christmas. And the big dish for Christmas is not turkey, because pork is the main meal in Christian Goa. Pork.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes some families will roast a suckling pork, stuff it with all kinds of coriander and mashed potatoes and things like that. But the main dish that people yearn for is something called sor patel, which is a pork stew. And the tradition was that you took various parts of the pig. You took the neck and shoulders, but you also took the tail and the ears. And now people are doing without the tail and the ears. And they're just taking the meat from the neck and the shoulders and sometimes the liver. And this is all stewed up with cumin and chilies and ginger and garlic and vinegar. The traditional thing with a lot of stews in this area, including the vindaloo, which comes from Goa, is using vinegar when you're grinding the spices, because the vinegar made the stew last. And in the days when there was no refrigeration, all you had to do was heat up the stew every day and let it sit. Just let it sit, and the vinegar held it for day after day.
So
if you had guests coming in, 2 days later, they could still eat this huge, lovely stew. So this would be the main meal, but this is for Christmas Day itself. But the day before, everybody goes to church to midnight mass.
Right.
And that is so beautiful. I went with the families many, many times. So what they do at night, 11:30 or so, because the whitewashed churches are set right in the middle of the rice paddies. And every neighborhood has a whitewashed church. So you go at night with your flashlights and you go in a little procession and you go and you attend midnight mass. And then you come out and the whole area is lit up with is three-dimensional stars is how I would describe it. They're fluffy, fat stars made with paper and cane in which there's a candle. And these are all over. So it's like a sky above and a sky below of stars. It is so beautiful. So you come back and there are people singing Christmas carols. And it's actually quite funny because they're singing Dashing Through the Snow and the palm trees swaying back and forth. It's a wonderful mixture of East and West. And then you come back and then the next day is Christmas Day. So you have your sor patel, you have your sannas, you have a salad, which could be made with cabbage. It could be made with lettuce. And it's absolutely gorgeous. And then you have your dessert.
Now, what is dessert?
And the dessert is my favorite, absolutely. When you eat it, if you don't know what you're eating, it tastes a little bit like a plum pudding. But there's nothing like that in it. In the olden days, the recipe used to say take 40 eggs, highly cholesterol-y, but now it's down to a smaller one with 10 eggs. And you have coconut milk, flour, and palm sugar. And this, what you do is, they have these little ovens which are heated with coconut husks. And you, in a little tray, you pour in one pancake and you put it in this oven which has coconut husks on top and at the bottom. So your heat coming from two sides and you cook one pancake. Then you pour another pancake and you bake that. Then you pour another and another.
So it's like layers
of
cake.
It's like a Napoleon of pancakes, but they're so coconutty, and the palm sugar keeps caramelizing as you go along. And it is heavenly. As you're leaving Goa, there are signs, a huge billboard saying, have you taken a bibik? It's called a bibinka or a bibik. Have you bought your bibik to take to your friends overseas? Because it is one of the most heavenly desserts I've ever had.
Mater, you have 19 million Christians, but what about the rest of India? Because this is the time of the winter solstice, and I would imagine that there are rituals. How is this time marked?
Well, the winter solstice, one of the ways it's marked is by Shivratri, which is prayers to the Lord Shiva, who is the creator of the universe. And one of the ways they do it, which I always loved and participated in, if my cousins would let me, my male cousins, is flying kites. So everybody in every city goes to the roof of their houses.
Uh-huh.
And you fly kites and you have kite contests. It is so wonderful. I love it. And the sky is filled with multicolored kites. Everywhere you look, there are kites flying and people, you know, just celebrating with kites.
Beautiful image. Madhur, thank you.
Thank you.
Madhur Jaffrey is author of From Curries to Kebabs, Recipes from the Indian Spice Trail. You can get her recipe for Goan pork with potatoes on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, no way is this holiday special ending before I have my word about Italy. Both sides of my family are Italian, Tuscan and Venetian. And I guess I've spent maybe 20 years of my professional life roaming the countryside. You know, Italy is a lot like India. In fact, it's like us. I mean, different areas celebrate differently. And you never tell the people of one valley how good the food is in the next valley. First of all, they'll wonder why you ever wanted to go there in the first place. And secondly, knowing that how they eat cannot be contested, they'll probably think that you're nuts. So Christmas in Italy is not what you might think. I mean, for instance, in Ferrara, that old Renaissance capital of the north, you might start with thin slivers of goose breast prosciutto. Why? Well, in the 1200s, the Dukes of Ferrara offered the city as a safe haven for the persecuted Jews. Well, with the Jews not eating pork, they cured the goose. Now all of Ferrara eats goose prosciutto. Across the plain in Bologna, Christmas dinner has to begin with little sacred navels in broth. Now, that's the nickname for tortellini, because legend says that they were modeled after Venus's belly button. What may surprise you is what happens in some areas way down in the heel of the boot, the Puglia region. Now, there, instead of the usual capon or turkey, a main meat might be lamb, because sheep thrive in the hot, dry climate. Also in Puglia, you might be served bowls of steaming hot Christmas orzo in swallow's milk. That's right, bird milk. It's a very old dish, and it probably goes back to when the ancient Arabs and Greeks settled in Puglia. Swallow's milk is really almond milk. What you do is you soak really tasty ground almonds in hot water until it's like an almond essence. And then you strain away the nuts, and you flavor the milk with honey or sugar, and you cook these little pastas in it. Now, on the other side of the boot, in the center of Sicily, they're planting wheat right now. Now, you always planted wheat at the darkest time of year so that you could harvest it at the brightest time. It went into the ground at the winter solstice, and it came away from the earth in June, the summer solstice. You see, wheat was the money crop of the Mediterranean. It was its most important food. So there is this dish that's traditional at this time, and it's still eaten by wheat farmers and by most of Sicily. The dish is called cuccia, and it has always been considered an act of faith because this is betting that there's going to be more grain in the next harvest. Now, you made cuccia by boiling wheat berries until they're soft and nutty tasting. Then you spoon them into bowls and you top them with creamy ricotta, drizzles of honey, and a handful of raisins. I've put my recipe for cuccia up on the website, splendidtable.org. I must say, at this point, I feel compelled to leave you with a bit of practical advice. Now, in this time of feasting, odds are this week you are going to wind up with a horrendous stain down the front of your shirt and probably a destroyed tablecloth to boot. I want to introduce you to someone, a food stain doctor, Jerry Posniak of Cameo Cleaners in Gramercy Park, New York. Jerry, nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, I know you are a dry cleaner, but you've also got some culinary background, from what I understand. Is that right?
That is correct. About 6 or 7 years ago, finished up a certificate program at the French Culinary Institute here in New York City.
So this sort of gives you a deeper understanding of what you're dealing with in terms of stains, or did you do this because you love to cook?
Well, I love to cook, but after I finished the program, I realized that I can definitely use the knowledge that I received at the French Culinary Institute to further the kind of dry cleaning, especially since we deal with a higher-end clientele here at the shop.
Uh-huh. I love specialists. Well, okay. I want to know, what is the most common stain that you see?
Believe it or not, the most common thing that we get over the counter is usually salad oil or salad dressings, balsamic vinaigrette.
Uh-huh.
What I see most of.
So how do you treat that particular one? Because that's pretty common at our house, too.
Well, on a dry cleaning standpoint, the oil component is something that dissolves instantaneously in dry cleaning fluid, so that's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sugar component in the balsamic vinegar is generally removable by what we would call wet side chemistry, or something which is a water-based stain remover.
Is there anything we can do before we bring you the items that would help the process?
The best thing is to leave the stain alone. To be honest, I mean, well-meaning wait staff in restaurants putting club soda or salt on stains just sometimes will actually create a larger problem for me as a dry cleaner. I would prefer my clients to, and this is the advice that I give my clients all the time, is to leave it alone, blot it, don't rub, never rub on a stain because rubbing will actually may cause chafing of the fabric, which is not reversible. So just blot it, leave it alone.
Okay. So when I get that big blob of salad dressing on the front of the silk blouse, just let it sit.
Well, leave it alone because, you know, oil and water won't mix. So if you add water to an oil-based stain, you're really not going to remove it. You may make it worse, especially if the silk top that you're wearing is sensitive to water. You may leave a water ring. You may actually cause colors to bleed if it's, say, it's a multicolored silk top.
Mm-hmm.
So you're better off leaving it alone.
Well, I have to tell you, Jerry, I wish you did house calls.
Well, in fact, many of our clients will send us garments and household items from across the country. In fact, I have an interesting story of a client who once was on honeymoon in Tuscany and spilled red wine on a white linen top, and she sent it to me Federal Express from from Tuscany so that I can make sure that blouse was right for her when she got back from her honeymoon.
Well, if you see a big package coming in from Minnesota, you'll know who it's from. Thanks a lot.
I'll take good care of it for you.
Thank you, Jerry.
You're welcome.
Jerry Posniak is owner of Cameo Cleaners in New York City. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this toast. From all of us here at the Splendid Table, we raise a glass to you. May your home never be big enough to hold all your friends. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, nearly everything you will ever need in life can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're solving life's little problems, be sure to register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You'll find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by the new Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection, gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at MuirGlen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham, Julia Schrankler, and Jeff Harkness. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.